The Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society Podcast.
Welcome to the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, a podcast dedicated to suspense, crime, and horror stories from the golden age of radio. I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
We love mysterious old-time radio stories, but do they stand the test of time? That's what we're here to find out.
This week, I've chosen an episode of Quiet Please entitled The Hat, The Bed, and John J. Catherine.
Quiet Please was the brainchild of radio and screenwriter Willis Cooper, creator of another legendary series, Lights Out. The program debuted on the Mutual Broadcasting Network on June 8, 1947. In September 1948, it moved to ABC, where it remained until its final broadcast on June 25, 1949. In total, Cooper wrote 101 original scripts for the series, along with 5 repeats for a total of 106 broadcasts.
Quiet Please is often labeled a horror series, probably because of Cooper's roots in the genre, but as a May 1949 article in Writer's Digest noted, there's no formula or pattern to Quiet Please, other than it is always narrated in the first person by Ernest Chappell and has an eerie, slow-paced mood. Sometimes macabre, sometimes hilarious, but always entertaining. The same article reported that ABC received more listener requests for Quiet Please scripts than for any other program.
The Hat, The Bed, and John J. Catherine was the third-to-last episode of the series, followed by 2 recycled scripts, Pavane, retitled from The Girl with the Flaxen Hair, and the final broadcast, Quiet Please, named for the program itself. That means you're about to hear the last original script Willis Cooper ever wrote for Quiet Please, first broadcast on June 11th, 1949.
It's late at night, and a chill has set in. You're alone, and the only light you see is coming from an antique radio. Listen to the sounds coming from the speaker, listen to the music, and listen to the voices.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please. American Broadcasting Company presents Quiet Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet Please for tonight is called The Hat, The Bed, and John J. Catherine.
When I talk to you about John J. Catherine, I'm talking about me. I've got into more battles about my last name. I've had to make it clear to at least 4 million people that Catherine is my last name, not my first. And in the process, I have accumulated more numerous contusions, fractures, superficial abrasions, black eyes, and bloody noses than can readily be counted by one person. Now, disregard my personal adventures in the field of fisticuffs for a moment, and attune your shell-like ear to the singular story of the hat and the bed and me. However, don't get carried away to the extent of thinking of me as Kitty, or Kate, or any of the other diminutives of my last name, or I am quite likely to wrap you smartly over the sconce with a stage brace. I much prefer, if you must be familiar, to be addressed by my usual sobriquet of Gentleman Johnny. However, I am just as happy when you call me Mr. Catherine. Just wanted to make myself perfectly clear. My profession is that of a stagehand. To continue our brief gander at my personal history and to orient you somewhat concerning myself, I've carried a card in the IATSE ever since the actor's strike, which more or less dates me. As a matter of fact, and strictly between you and I, me, there was a time when I entertained certain ambitions myself. When I left Rockford as a young man, valedictorian of my class at Rockford High, I studied with Christensen in Chicago for 4 months. Then the lamented Thomas Wood Stevens once said that I had legs like Bert Lytell's. And though I have devoted my energies to another phase of the theater for lo these many years, I am still able to offer slight competition to these young upstarts who people the stage today. to linger after an evening performance to try my slightly decrepit wings alone in the house at midnight. Nay, I will win my wager better yet and show more signs of her obedience, her new-built virtue and obedience. See where she comes and brings your froward wives as prisoners to her womanly persuasion. Why, there's a wench. Come and kiss me, Kate. The Bard, Taming of the Shrew, Act 5, Scene 2, Petruchio speaking to Katharina. I could go on for 3 days.
Before you go on for 3 days, Mr. Catherine, suppose you step over here and give these boys a hand with the scenery for the next act, huh? And make it snappy, Mr. Catherine? That our boy, Mr. Catherine.
Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 2.
John Catherine been telling you how he'd have wowed him in Grand Rapids if he'd stuck to his first love, the theater? Don't you listen to it. First thing you know, we'll have you talked into angeling a production of Shakespearean repertory in somebody's cow barn for the summer, starring John J. Catherine as King Lear, Macbeth, Shylock, and assorted King's Henry. And I'm not going to let anybody spoil the best stagehand I ever saw to make a fourth-rate ham actor out of him. Not that he isn't a fourth-rate ham actor already. Me? I'm Evelyn Pierce. I produce plays and things, and I think John J. Catherine hates my viscera. I don't mean to be mean to John. I like him. But we got work to do putting on a play, and that's the stagehand's business. Oh, hello, John. Back so quickly?
Miss Pierce, I quit.
Again, John?
For positively the last final definitive time, Miss Pierce, I quit. I am done. I resign. I will take it up with the union if need be, but I unequivocably, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Unequivocably resign. Is that clear, Miss Pierce?
Quite, John. But why, if you please?
That set dresser.
What set dresser?
That man, that unspeakable man that goes around putting things on things, flowers on tables and telephone books on stands, candlesticks on the mantel. He put my hat on the bed.
Oh.
And so, Miss Pierce, I...
Unequivocably resign.
It is so. Fare you well.
Where are you going, John?
I said I quit, Miss B.
Where are you going?
I'm going to the mortician's. I'm going, Miss Pierce, to the mortician's to talk over certain details.
Details of what, John?
A funeral, Miss Pierce.
A funeral, John?
My funeral, Miss Pierce.
I don't quite understand you, John.
Miss Pierce, are you unaware that a hat placed on a bed is a sure sign of death? Please omit the flowers, Miss Pierce.
I wish you people would... Oh, John Catherine.
Hello, Miss Pierce.
Aren't you dead, too?
No, ma'am. Did I wake you up?
As a matter of fact, you did, John. Is there something I can do for you?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Miss Pierce.
Well, what? I was taking a nap.
You were asleep?
I was. I'm tired.
I didn't get much sleep last night.
No?
Nor the night before, either. Sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care. Macbeth, Act 2, Scene 2.
Death Counterfeit, Act 2, Scene 3.
It scares me.
What scares you? Macbeth?
Sleep. I'm afraid to go to sleep. Oh, I'm so sleepy.
Well, can I do something for you, John?
I could tell you about my dream.
Well, John, really, I'm afraid.
So am I. Something's got to be done.
You want me to do something? You mean you want to come back to work, John?
I want to tell you about my dream, Miss Pierce.
Well, come on in.
Well, thank you.
Sit down, John.
Thank you.
Will I light a cigarette? Cigarette, John?
I don't smoke, Miss Pierce.
Oh, yes, I forgot. Well?
I hardly know where to begin.
I haven't got much time.
I know. Neither have I.
Go ahead, John.
Well, the hat, you know, and the bed.
It's only a superstition, John.
That's what people say.
I didn't know you were superstitious.
Well, I don't know whether I am or not. I'm so sleepy all the time, I can't remember things. I don't know what... Oh, I don't know.
Now, see here, John.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm just afraid of dying. Are you afraid of dying, Miss Pierce?
I've never thought of it specially.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to die. You see, I know what it's like. Kind of.
Now, John, if that's all...
Now, listen. I was really scared when I left the theater last night. I really did call up a mortician to arrange things, you know.
Said you were.
I couldn't get him on the phone. So after a while, I lay down as one who wraps the drapery of his couch about him.
And lies down to peaceful dreams, Thanatopsis, William Cullen Bryant.
Yeah, thank you. But I didn't dream, peacefully or unpeacefully.
But you said you did.
No, ma'am, I just went to sleep.
But you said you dreamed, John. You said you wanted to tell me your dream. That's what you said.
I know. When I woke up, it was real late. Really late, I mean. Very late. It was dark. Black dark. I could hardly see the light from the window. Couldn't see it at all, as a matter of fact. Black dark, and I was so thirsty. I had to have a drink of water. My mouth was just parched.
Sleeping with your mouth open.
I suppose. Well, after a while, I couldn't stand it any longer, so I got up. Now, the bathroom's here, you see. My bed is like this, and the dresser's over here. And there's a chair.
Uh-huh.
I got up, and I couldn't find the light switch. I knew I could find my way in the dark to the bathroom, all right, and I did. I got my drink of water, and my goodness, it tasted good. And then I started back to bed. When I came back, the bed was gone. There wasn't any bed. There wasn't any chair where I knew the chair was. And the dresser was gone, too. There wasn't anything in the room.
John, you were dreaming.
No, I wasn't dreaming. I wandered around there in the dark for ever so long. There wasn't anything in the room, I tell you. My gracious, Miss Pierce, I can walk 3 steps from my bathroom door right to the edge of my bed. It's a little low bed. I bump it with my knee. It's a little room, Miss Pierce. You can't walk around there in the light without bumping into something. The chair or the dresser or the bed or the little table. I forgot where I keep my collected plays of Shakespeare right kind of by my bed. Where the light is. I couldn't find the light. I couldn't find any light.
And I don't understand it, John.
Because of the hat on the bed.
Oh, John.
That's right.
That's because you had a bad dream.
It wasn't a dream.
You said you wanted to tell me your dream.
The only way I could think to describe it. But it wasn't a dream. Just a big, empty place. Dark, black dark, empty. I've been very badly frightened, Miss Pierce.
What happened when you waked up, John?
I wasn't asleep. It wasn't a dream. It was a kind of preview of death, Miss Pierce.
Oh, no, John. A dream. Now, don't sit there and shake your head, John. I've had dreams like that myself. Extraordinarily vivid dreams that leave me wondering when I wake up whether I... John, you're not listening to me.
Oh, I'm so sleepy, Miss Pierce.
Well, you're not going to sleep in my house now.
I won't go to sleep, Miss Pierce. I'm afraid to go to sleep.
Afraid of dreaming.
I don't know what I'm afraid of.
Well, cigarette, John?
I don't smoke, Miss Pierce.
I forgot.
It's all right.
Well, it is an extraordinary experience, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, why'd you come to tell me about it? Did you... I mean, I'll be glad to have you go back to work if you want to. You want to do that?
No, I don't think so. I just wanted to tell you about it.
Why, me especially, John?
Oh, gracious, don't you know?
John, I'm very flattered, really, and you know,
you
but...
You don't know?
Of course not.
Well, you were there.
I was there?
Yes, Miss Pierce.
I've never heard anything so absurd in all my life. What was I doing there?
In the dark? What were you doing? Why, I don't know what you were doing. You were just there.
Now, John, that's absurd. How do you know I was there? You said it was dark. You couldn't see anything.
You were there, Miss Pierce.
John, I don't know what you're talking about. You're drunk or...
I don't drink, Miss Pierce.
And I wasn't at your house either. You know perfectly well I was.
It wasn't at my house.
You said...
I said I came out of the bathroom and I thought it was my room. But it wasn't. It was just a great big dark empty space.
John, when was all this?
Why, last night.
Oh.
I went right home from the theater, you know, and And I went to bed like I...
When you saw the hat on the bed, you came to me and said you quit?
Of course. Last night, I...
John.
Yes, ma'am.
It was Thursday night you quit.
What?
3 days ago, not last night. 3 days ago, John.
3 days ago?
Where have you been for 3 days, John?
Why, I guess I've been dead.
John, I think you'd better get the... What are you staring at?
Miss Pierce, you got your hat on the bed.
All right, John, come on.
Come on, where?
I'm going to take my hat off the bed, John.
It's too late now.
Too late?
Sign it, Dad.
Oh, stop that nonsense. I'm going to put on my hat and get back to the theater. That play I'm trying to do will die the death.
Oh, don't talk that way.
Stop it. Come on. You go back with me. Go back to work if you want to. Now, you see? See, I've got my hat. Now, let's go. Time to go, John.
Something will happen to us, Miss Pierce.
What? Get run over by a taxi?
Don't talk that way.
Oh, stop it, Catherine.
Miss Pierce, you know I don't like to be called by my last name.
Sometimes I'm not sure whether that's your last name or your first.
You're not to talk to me that way, Miss Pierce.
All right, then. Stop acting like an old maid and come along with
you. I don't want you talking to me like that.
All right, just stop talking nonsense then and come on with me. Coming? I said, are you coming with me?
No, I'm not coming.
John, I've got
you. You're not going either.
Now, look, this is silly. Why aren't you?
I'm afraid.
Well, you're not going to stay here.
Please.
No, come on. Now, get up and come with me.
Won't you go either?
John, are you all right?
I'm afraid.
What am I going to do with you?
The hat on the bed, that was a sign of death for me, and I died a little the other night, whenever it was.
You had a bad dream.
And now your hat was on the bed. That's a sign of death for you.
That's ridiculous.
You're going to die.
Now, John, I've listened to just about everything I'm going to listen to. You just get up out of that chair and come on.
No.
Yes.
Please.
John, would you like it if I left you here?
No.
Look, John, it's 2:30, and I've got to be at the theater at 3:00. Here, I'll put this nice pillow under your head. Now, won't that be nice and comfortable, John?
So sleepy.
Sure, Johnny Cap. You'll be all right. You just stay there nice in the big chair, and I'll go to the theater. Then I'll come back. You'll see.
Don't get killed.
Of course I won't. I'll be all right, Johnny Cassidy. And you'll be all right, too, right here. Go on. Go to sleep, John.
I'm afraid to go to sleep.
Poor guy is all worn out.
I'm afraid.
Well, you sleep, boy. I'll be back around 10:00. John. Good heavens, it's 2:45 already. Oh, darn, I won't answer it. Oh, I'm late already, I tell you. All right. Yes. Oh, hello, Tony. Yes, I'm on my way to the theater. I haven't got a minute to talk. Yes. Yes, I'll be home about 10, I hope. Matter of fact, I think you better. I'll tell you when I see you. Yes, here at the house. Well, I might have somebody I want you to get rid of. Wait. No, he's asleep. No, I'm not living a life of sin. This is one of the stagehands from the John J. Catherine, no less. That's right, the distinguished Shakespearean actor and quoter. I don't know, potted, I think, or else he's losing his buttons. Too much King Lear, I guess. Oh, no, I'm leaving him here to sleep it off. Oh, hats on a bed, all that stuff. Oh, he's all right now, as long as I'm not here. Look, Tony, I'm late. Suppose you meet me here at the house around 10. Sure. If he's still here, I'll let you throw him out. I'm going to run. Goodbye. I'll see you tonight. Bye. You all right, John Cassidy? You asleep? John? Poor fella.
What was this? Where? Oh, Miss Pierce's house. Oh, I'm so thirsty. What time is it? 2:45. I can't Street, my watch. Where's all the lights? Oh, where do I get a drink of water? Oh, hey, left in the blankets. Hey, where's Miss Pierce? Miss Pierce! Trussed up hand and foot like a fowl, like a pullet, like a capon. Miss Pierce! Oh, yes, she went out. What am I doing here? Oh, I remember. My gracious, I have to get out of here before she comes back. My mouth. I shouldn't have had those cocktails before I came over here. I should know I can't drink. What I need is a big cold drink of water. Nice place you got here, Miss Pierce. Nice place you got, although I can't say I like philodendrons. Where's your kitchen? I want a drink of water. I wish I could find a light. Oh, here it is. Oh, 11:45 it is. I better be getting out of here after I get a drink. Kitchen. Mighty little kitchen. Nice little kitchen. Now, where's the glass? There, we have glasses. Oh, man. Nothing like cold water. Thank you, Miss Pierce. Thank you very much, Miss Pierce. I find your drinking water excellent, although it could be just a spot colder. Miss Pierce, I dislike you intensely. I do not love thee, Dr. Fell, a reason why I cannot tell, but this I know and know full well I do not love thee, Miss Pierce. Although the why is not in my mind, in the mind of John J. Catherine, my friends, who might be the idol of millions, nay, billions, if Miss Evelyn Pierce, the eminent producer, would give him a chance to tread the boards. Tread the boards in sock and muskin. Hand me my sock, Violet. I prithee trust my points, and I will reward thee with a cup of sack. Sack of cups. Trust my points, whatever that is, Wanda, and I will reward thee with a cup of sack. Yeah, Sir Walter Scott must have been a little stiff when he wrote that. Thou hast looked upon the wine when it is red, Sir Walter. Thou hast looked upon it when it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adding machine. Yeah, thou art very funny this night, Sir John J. Catherine. Albeit a trifle corny, sirrah. I've got to get my large, bulky carcass out of here before Miss Pierce comes back, or else Miss Pierce and I will get in a fight, and then I won't get my job back. Much less get a job as a broad cheddar in sock and buskin. Remind me to ask Miss Pierce what is a buskin. I know what a sock is, Miss Pierce. A sock is what I'm going to give you in your pretty teeth if you don't stop being so mean to me, to Sir John J. Catherine, the sock and buskin man from Rockford, Illinois. He got not to mention, forsooth, Bassanio, my head hangeth over. I am now undrunk. Well, they would, my fair and fair to middling friend, they would that thou would spiel to me whether this beldame hath perchance a small flagon of bourbon concealed on her about the premises. For I would drink of same and restore myself. Anon. Is there no way, as Pierre-Louis has the little girl say to Demetrius? Is there no bourbon? What drinkest thou, Pierce? No scotch, no creme vet? No vintage wine, no. Aha! I see you, John Jameson's excellent pot still product, of which our Miss Pierce will miss not a jot or a tittle out of a bottle which I will tipple. Thank you, Miss Pierce. You have a regrettable habit of leaving hats on beds. But here's to you. That is meat and drink, not to mention pie in the sky. Je vous remercie, Miss Pierce. No, Mademoiselle Pierce out here remarked in his flawless flinch. Thank you. I will have another dollar for the same, Miss Pierce. You undelightful old bag, old sack, old cover sack. Arigato, Pierson, he remarked in flawless Japanese. And for this short snort, which will cure my hangover completely. Short. I will
say in my flawless double talk, Framus on the Scrivenae. Now, I will replace this somewhat attenuated bottle from which I have received back my body and my soul, reading from left to right. And before I retire into the stilly night, I will favor this large and intelligent audience with a selection from the Bard. Not Ben Bard, he is a comic. The Bard of Avon, situate by an odd coincidence hard by the banks of the River Stratford, or vice versa, as the case may be, in sunny England, which I will favor you with a large, jagged hunk of Shakespeare. Or as my ancient and deceased friend, what was his name in the shelves of many, many years ago, was wont to say, Shakespeare. Russian for Shakespeare. I crave your attention. Mr. John J. Catherine as Macbeth. Is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I see thee still. Art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? Or art thou but a dagger of the mind, a false creation proceeding from the heat-oppressed brain? I see thee yet, in form as palpable as this which now I draw. The lights went out. Here's the lights. Miss Pierce, turn on the lights. Miss Pierce isn't here. Where's Miss Pierce? Yeah, I'm going to get out of here, Miss Pierce. You come in your nice house in the dark, find me here all full of your liquor. Yeah, where's the door? I can't find the door. I can't find... Where's the chair? Where's the door? Miss Pierce! Please, Miss Pierce! I'm lost again in the dark. Miss Pierce, has happened again. You did it to me this time, Miss Pierce. You put your hat on the bed and you made it dark in your house, too. Miss Pierce, I'm lost. This is no dream. Miss Pierce, where are you? Where am I? Where's the door? Where's the door? Oh, where does it go? I know where this door goes. This is the door that... Miss Pierce, where does this door go? You went and you put your hat on the bed, you did. You put your hat on the bed. You put your hat on the bed. That's a sign of death, Miss Pierce, putting your hat on the bed. Where? Well, I can't see on it. Oh, I know where I am now. Oh, I was so scared. Never mind, Miss Pierce. I know where I am now. Here's a chair. Hello, chair. It's a little table. Good evening, little table in the dark. I beg your pardon, table. And I'm all right now, Miss Pierce. I'll get out just as soon as I can find the door in the dark, Miss Pierce. Oh, how I hate Miss Pierce. I'm going. Oh, here's the bed, isn't it? The bed. Yes. The bed, Miss Pierce. That's where you threw your hat. Hat on the bed. Sign of death, old neighbors. I guess I'll just lie down and take me a little rest. Why, your hat's still here on the bed, Miss Pierce. Sign of death, Miss Pierce, leaving your hat on the bed. Sign of death for sure. Silly old Miss Pierce, leaving your hat on the bed. Why, Miss Pierce, you left your head inside your hat.
The title of tonight's Quiet Please story is The Hat, The Bed, and John J. Catherine. It was written and directed by Willis Cooper. The man who spoke to you was Ernest Chappell.
And Miss Pierce was played by Nancy Sheridan. As usual, music for Quiet Please is by Albert Berman. For a word about next week's Quiet Please, here is our writer-director, my good friend Willis Cooper. Okay, Bill?
Thank you for listening to Quiet Please. Next week's story is called La Fille au Chevalier. The girl with the flaxen hair.
And so until next week, and La Fille au Chevalier. I am glad to yours, Ernest Chappell.
That was The Hat, The Bed, and John J. Catherine from Quiet Please, here in the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society podcast. Once again, I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
Can you please hang with me for the entire thought process of what I'm about to tell you?
Okay.
No?
Please, come on.
Can I say no?
Yeah, you can, but you're not.
Go ahead.
So I'm listening to this thing. Let's say it's 30 minutes long. I don't know exactly how long. Let's say it's 30 minutes long. For 29 minutes and 50 seconds of this, I was going like this. Whatever. I'm so bored. I hate this. And at the very end, I went, oh, my God, this is brilliant. Oh, your head's still in your hat. Knock on the door. And I went, oh, I was so bored and I didn't like it. And then I realized, oh my God, I love this so much. It is a risky storytelling in the sense of you have to stick with this until the last sentence to get what's happening and why. And even then, we're not sure what has happened. Was he dreaming the whole thing and woke up after killing her because he hated her? I know these are all things we're going to discuss, and there's so many levels to this, but I just wanted you to hear that I went from boo to wow. It was really fun.
Wow.
It was really fun for me to have that moment. I literally stood up from my chair and went, oh, cool. So thank you, Joshua.
You're welcome. I suppose now I have to wait to see what Tim's broad stroke opinion is.
This is not that, but the title of this is pretty close to iambic pentameter.
Oh, look at you. And
that
he was a Shakespearean.
Does not surprise me.
Look at you picking up on that.
Nice.
The John Jay is a little more of a spondy than an iamb,
but you can kind of retcon that and say John J. Catherine would probably half-ass his iambic pentameter yes. as a character.
Right, right. Good point.
I loved this, and part of that was having faith in Willis Cooper. Of I don't know how long that speech at the end is.
Yeah.
It's a full 10 minutes.
Yes.
The fact that I have faith that, all right, this is going to be something means I can just sit back and enjoy this.
And right. That's an important point because I think the speech is funny and enjoyable.
Yes.
In and of itself.
Yeah. It was in the second time through.
Did you learn a lesson?
I sure did. Listen, I am not going to defend my. I learned a very good lesson in this of stop being so judgy.
I'm relieved that Eric in particular enjoyed it. I wasn't sure exactly where Tim would land, but I honestly first heard this a while ago when our patron Amy recommended it for one of our happy hours. We were doing a happy hour that was a theater and actor themed.
Sure. Right,
and I
right.
listened to it and I went, no, this is mine. I'm bringing it to the podcast. But then what happened is I thought for sure I would have to defend it really hard. Mm-hmm. And depending on the day we record, sometimes right. I'm like, I don't really have the fight in me. And it's a new year. And I kind of, in keeping with what Tim said about the cave, I went, I'm bringing an episode for me.
Well, what
and let the chips fall where they may.
And what did I do last week?
Yep.
For a dangerous thing. Assignment. That was for me.
An unintentional New Year trilogy.
Right. For me. Screw
the
you guys.
Of the year. Yes. Yes. Screw
the
you.
Year of selfishness. but yeah, this just blew me away the first time I heard it. And like you, Eric, I wasn't sure I understood anything that happened.
Right.
But I bits and pieces of it made me realize that there was a lot going on in it. And then I listened to it a second time and I was like, I'm not sure what happened. And I don't think it was till like the third time that I started to really feel like I could see many of the things Cooper was doing all at the same time. Not right. that part of what I love about this is that it is so ambiguous and it sort of refuses a singular interpretation. It can be everything at once? Is this story about masculine anxiety? There's a lot of that in here. Is it a story of the acceptance of death? There's all this literary reference throughout it from Macbeth. The other poem I'm forgetting about, it's Greek, but it means a consideration of death that he quotes with, like, where you're equating sleep and death. Is it about social isolation? He's totally abandoned by the theater community. He's a relic. He's alone. Is it about theater as sexual sublimation? I don't know. You could just go on and on. Or is it a parable about alcoholism?
Correct.
All these things at
you
once.
You know, what I love about this is that we're discussing it, because this is the best episode ever in our 400 and some episodes for what amounts to a really good opportunity for, like, a book club type discussion.
It's very literary.
What did you think? What did you think of this? Well, what does this mean? What about that? Oh, I would think, you know, this, we could go on and on. For example, there's a great moment where, and I think my favorite, other than your head's in the hat, where she offers him a cigarette and he says, "I don't smoke, you know that." And I don't know how long later, 4 minutes later, "Would you like a cigarette?" And he says, "You know, I don't smoke." And she says, "Oh yeah, I forgot." Mm-hmm. The second time she offers him a cigarette and he just states the same thing and she responds the same way is odd the first time through, because you go, why wouldn't you respond, "Hey, I just told you I don't smoke like 2 minutes ago." And why didn't she respond with, "Oh, right, sorry, I forgot." Instead of, so the reason I love that is because it leads me down where I believe this is. Like, I know it's ambiguous, but there's a part of me that just wants to wrap my head around it completely. Mm-hmm. That part of it tells me that he, at that moment, is in a blackout drunk dream, because that's a dream thing to happen. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? And that's brilliant writing, where someone repeats something, or and that kind of thing happens in a dream that doesn't make sense.
To support that idea, he also, in that same conversation, is offered a drink, and he says he doesn't drink.
Right. Correct.
Or he says, "I'm not drunk," when she accuses him of being drunk. And then she leaves and he wakes up and he's like, "Oh, I shouldn't have had all those cocktails before I got
he
here."
He says he doesn't.
Absolutely contradicts.
But she does offer him a drink and he says, "I don't drink."
Oh, he does.
Yeah, 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 he says, "I don't drink."
Yeah.
Which is what you might say in your dream, yeah. You know, like, and then, yes, I believe, this is my theory, this entire thing is a dream. I think that he's mad at it, at his job, doesn't like her, gets drunk, and what we're listening to, all of it is a dream. That, including the dark room, is symbolic of a blackout drunk, and not being able to find anything and find your way through is blackout drunk. But then I think that the moment it stops being a dream is the last 10-minute monologue where he wakes up in her house. I think he goes over there drunk and he kills her and then passes out. The other thing that's interesting, what time? They're very specific. "I'll be home," she says on the phone, "by 10. Mm-hmm. What time is it when he wakes up and sees the clock? It's close to midnight.
Yeah.
So we already know that she should have been home by then. So I think that was part of the dream as well. I think,
but he describes a dream, or what he calls a preview of death, in which everything that happens once Miss Pierce leaves her apartment happens again.
Yes.
But he says in that first dream or preview of death that she was there with him.
Right,
so
which is dreamlike as well.
Experienced it.
Yes.
One of the aspects of it that fascinates me is how aware both of them are that they are performing. She is introduced when she interrupts his first person narration to the listener.
Yeah.
And she contradicts him, and they're competing for unreliable narrator status.
Right.
And then you have those things where he's quitting, and he's quit before, and he checks his grammar with her. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm meandering my way back to your point. There's almost an interpretation of repeating, "Do you want a cigarette? No thanks, I don't smoke," to dropping a line and finding your way back into the script quality.
When that particular exchange of hearing again, like, "Do you want a cigarette? I don't smoke," and going back to that, it made me think of Waiting for Godot, to support this idea of this is a show about shows, but which is not to say that that denies any other interpretation, because it does open itself up to all these things that you've said. At the opening, their relationship seemed so, to me, amicable. They seemed like just a fun back-and-forth comedy duo.
Mm-hmm.
That it was weird to see that ebb and flow until finally this is not funny at all.
But even when they're being comic and lighthearted with each other,
it's antagonistic a little bit, yeah.
The words they're actually saying is, he hates my viscera, right?
Yes,
and
right.
And he says, I hate you. I do not like you at all. He does that twist on the nursery rhyme during his 10-minute monologue. Like, it is repeated again and again. But
in his monologue, it's I hate her, but I want her.
Yeah, because she can let me back into the theater.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating thing you just said, Tim. The dialogue and the banter of this does remind me of, and I'm going to be a total on-purpose nerd, it does remind me of Waiting for Godot.
Nah.
But, by the way, I saw Bill Irwin at the Guthrie here performing, and he's done Godot a thousand times, and he addresses that and he says, you can call it Godot, it's fine.
Thank you, Bill Irwin.
Right. And he's the aficionado on the piece, and I was so relieved by that, because I was like, oh good, it's not pretentious. Anyway, the dialogue of this and the play of this, of those two in that scene, really is, I never realized that till now, it really does have that feel to it, doesn't it?
Like they're stuck
and it doesn't make sense what they're saying to each other, yet it does.
And back to the cave, when I heard the cave from a couple weeks ago that Tim brought, I was like, oh, what a pair these are, because there's a lot of cyclical repetition in here that he has quit over and over again. And then we have the repeat of the blackened room, the repeat of dialogue. There's all this repetition and cyclical
events. I shouldn't have had all those drinks. I should have some more drinks.
Yeah.
Right. Again, the dark room, for me, there is no way we can have this discussion. Anybody can end up on a definitive what the narrative is of this, right? But to me, the black room is absolutely representational blackout drunk.
It's also representing a dark theater, right? A closed theater.
Okay.
The curtain has fallen on his career.
Yeah, right.
He only gets on stage when it's dark. He has to hang out and go do his rambling Shakespeare monologues, which is exactly when he's in the dark room.
Yeah.
He goes right to doing the Macbeth dagger monologue. Which is also the monologue that Macbeth does right before he kills Duncan.
He refers to himself as the porter, and at the end there's knocking.
Yep.
Jesus.
And that end is great because it's absolutely ambiguous, yet that doorbell provides closure.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but
yeah.
While also leaving it incredibly open-ended because it doesn't answer. So the existence of a doorbell tells you in this darkened room, there's a door. And it's closed. Literal closure. It's shut. But there's someone behind that door who wants in.
Which is it's the guy that she said in the conversation. Tony that was going to come. I'll be home by 10. To me, it was him coming.
I think it's John Goodman who is staying in the hotel room next door.
Barton Fink.
There's a lot of Barton Finkiness in here.
But I think it's her body.
But you're also, you're right. It's just the head on the bed. The idea, though, is, oh, there's a head in here. Knock, knock. Is that moment where you realized, for me, oh, you've murdered somebody and now someone's at the door and you're going to get caught because you passed out drunk and didn't get out of there. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
I mean, at the very least, like, whatever situation got you here,
you're in trouble.
Yeah, right now, this is bad.
Knock, knock, and you know, oh, you're in trouble. Even if you didn't kill her for some reason, it's wonderful.
See what I'm landing? I'm like, yeah, a lot of Barton Fink.
Yeah, there's a lot of Barton Fink in that. Yeah,
I think Willis Cooper stole this from Barton Fink.
The thing that struck me too, because while John J. Catherine quotes a lot of Shakespeare, he comes back to Macbeth, and I think that's important. And it struck me that, in this story, if we are to believe that this is not a dream and he did kill in some blackout state or not remember it, or someone else killed
the Duncan stand-in.
Yeah.
Right.
That the hat on the bed as a superstition stands in for the Weird Sister's prophecy.
Oh, wow.
Because once he sees the hat on the bed, all his actions are in response to that. And it pushes him toward these actions that he may actually have always been harboring, his hatred of Miss Pierce. But the hat on the bed becomes the justification for it, the way the Weird Sister's prophecy that Macbeth will sit on the throne becomes his justification for all his actions going forward.
Wow.
But anyway, Macbeth, it's his head who's off at the end.
Yeah.
But so it's his own head. In the hat. We figured it out.
Yeah.
There it is.
There it is. Whoo.
But again, I'm
Tim, tell him stuff.
What did you see when he says, oh, and her head's still in it? Did you see the entire body?
I did.
Or did you see a dismembered head?
I see the whole body, that he's in the dark, feels the hat, and then realizes there's a head in it. And to me, it's just, oh, she's dead on the bed.
I saw a severed head.
My immediate thought was, severed head, but again, I'm wondering how much of that is the connections I unconsciously made with Barton Fink.
Or to Macbeth.
Because I would think he would say, you're still wearing the hat.
Yes.
Question for you guys. The hat on the bed...
Superstition?
Superstition. I cannot remember where I've heard it before. Was it something in this podcast?
Our very first Patreon only podcast was an episode of Origins of Superstition that dealt with
hat
on the bed.
Thank you. Right.
It was a bizarre, hilarious episode. I'm tempted to release it as a general audience preview along with this episode.
I was trying to rack my brain for where have I heard this theory before?
The superstitions of hat on bed, no hats on beds, and no shoes on a table.
Yeah.
Those are things I learned in college, and I still, I know in my mind it's fine, but it weirds me out to do it.
Really?
And was it through your theater experiences in college?
No, through friends.
Yeah, I'm weirded out by I don't say Macbeth in a theater. There's no justification for that.
There is another great connection focusing on Macbeth is the superstitious aspects of the play with the hat on the bed. And the hat on the bed, the most, I think, believable origin for that superstition is the European one that seems to trace it back to people on their deathbed, that the doctor or the priest coming in to do the last rites would, when they're tending to the patient or the person in bed, take their hat off and set it there.
Oh.
And so that became an omen of someone about to die. And also thematically with this play links all the ideas of sleep and death together. And the room and the bed.
So Willis Cooper was like super high when he wrote this.
Or just on speed. He was like, all these connections.
That was amazing.
Like if Willis Cooper sat down, I'm going to write like Arch Obler. I'm just going to vomit out everything in my head.
Right.
But it's so much better structure. Sorry to pick on Arch. I love Arch and what he does well. But this is...
Correct.
Pretty amazing. And then if you step even farther back, there's a level that this is just... him having a laugh. This is like some
this is
like
fun.
Shaggy dad joke told by David Lynch, right? Gotcha. And that's it did remind me of David Lynch, too, if we're talking about the Coen brothers. And very specifically that like the best of Lynch, and occasionally the Coen brothers, they do so many different styles, so it's not always pertinent to their work, but... there is an internal logic here that you can sense, but not really articulate. So while it is open-ended and ambiguous, that's why to me it feels satisfying.
Right.
We've often beat up on poor Scott Bishop of dark fantasy fame, but I mean, this, unlike Scott Bishop, who I think has an abundance of imagination, but way more imagination than he has technical proficiency in writing. Here you have somebody who has mastered the medium and the craft of writing and now he can start breaking all the rules. Right.
And that last speech, it's so much like it's spiraling and falling, and it just like, this isn't going to land anywhere. This is just going in infinite gibberish, not gibberish, but riffing on classic themes. And then it suddenly does. It ends quite abruptly.
I love his willingness. I mean, yes, a lazy writer's like, I'm going to put the entire Dagger monologue there. But that commitment was great. And it was great to hear Chapel do that monologue in this character, slightly drunk.
Yeah.
Like, such a great performance. And to me, it's why I emphasize in the intro that this is the last original script and feels to me like the last episode of Quiet Please. Right. And this is just a beautiful swan song, and that 10-minute monologue captures why these two men were just such an amazing team.
How about the fact that this is somewhat open-ended in a lot of this is open-ended, period, in a lot of ways, a lot of interpretations, not the least of which we don't know who's at the door or what's on the bed, or, you know, there's a lot of things. And I liked it.
I know. I am shocked.
And it doesn't bother me.
Thought the theater stuff might get you, but I was like, you got to have a lot of patience here.
Oh, you do need a lot of patience, because I ran out of patience and I was like,
I expect angry emails from us.
I will say this did not have any submarines.
Any what?
No submarines.
Oh, yeah, it did not have submarines. Lack,
but it has a lot of submerged ideas.
Oh, look at you.
Okay, I'm back on board.
Oh, there's another great theater death reference that I thought was pretty clever. I think it's when John is first describing the first dream that he says is a preview of death, and he's talking about stumbling across around the room, and he says, I couldn't find the light. I couldn't find any light, which on like my third listen was like, oh, we've got the idea of moving toward the light, but also this old actor who can't find his light anymore.
Right.
Again, brought me back to that image of a dark closed theater. And this dark room.
Parenthetical for folks who aren't theater carny folk out there, actors will often be chided to go find your light, which is theater lighting is in certain places on stage, and that you want to get the brightest part of the light on your face. And so often you'll find in less experienced actors, they have trouble getting their face lit.
Right.
So they look weird.
It is a skill set that actually I teach at the high school level, like find your light. And we do a whole thing where it doesn't take long, it takes 20 minutes, but then they actually learn, oh, I feel it.
Yeah.
I feel it. Oh, yeah. Now
feel
I'm
it
in
on
the
your
light.
Face.
Yeah.
I feel like we could talk about this for another 30 minutes.
We
but
absolutely
I think,
could.
I think we should go for our vote, though.
100%. Classic. I'm just voting. I love this so much. The fact that I was caught so off guard, this reminds me, please, I'm not comparing this, but the last time I felt this was the Sixth Sense movie, where I did not know I was the guy, and I went, what? He's dead?
Spoiler.
Yeah. And I freaked out, and the other one was, what's the what's the Kevin Spacey movie?
Usual Suspects?
Yeah. Usual Suspects. I had no idea.
Eyes are so zang.
I literally had those, in both of those movies, went, no! Like, and people I was with had figured it out 20 minutes earlier.
You're Luke's father.
But this gave me that thrill of, oh, whoa. And it has been a long time since something's caught me that off guard. Suspense tries so earnestly to give you that twist that you go, and I do, I go, good twist, but not this. And then to listen to it again, all these things we talked about, and some things I never thought of course. You guys have brought up a lot of things I didn't catch.
I'm sure there's tons that we missed.
Yeah.
It's something that you can listen to again and again and find new details.
Yep. So I will say this, and we made the joke that I have a top five that's now up to six. My top five is at seven. It's in
there. You have a doctor look at that. It's pretty swollen.
No, it's in there. It's in my top ever, for sure.
I will also say classic. It is both, like, this is technically, it's all the things you want in a radio show that it's done expertly.
And it is personally all the things that I'm like mad jealous of like,
oh, mm-hmm. right.
You know, writing theater stuff in a way that is great as opposed to just self-indulgent.
There's that too. There's that slight anger of, oh, I'm not that good a writer. I wish I could weave something that intricate.
Yeah,
I cannot.
I try to do. Like, no, you really can't get away with that unless you're Willis Cooper. Right.
One thing that, and I know we're voting, but I didn't say that I wanted to, and you kind of touched on it, Joshua. Ernest Chappell is so brilliant in this. He doesn't sound like Ernest Chappell.
The first time I listened to it, I had to go, oh, right, that's Ernest Chappell.
It's a brilliant piece of character work to step out of a show where you go, I love your voice. You sound like Ernest Chappell. I don't care. You know what I mean? Because I love your voice and I love your acting. This was, that's Ernest Chappell?
So, yeah, I think this falls short of class. I'm kidding. It is definitely a classic. Maybe if I could give it any caveat would be it's a cautious classic because I it's probably not for everyone.
No.
It does.
It's a classic for us.
It requires attentive yes. listening. This is the opposite of last week's
correct
background listening.
That punishes yeah. close listening.
But yes. if you know, you cannot wrap yourself in the drapery of the couch, to quote that poem earlier.
Right.
You need to sit up, lean in, and listen hard. But if you do, it is so rewarding. It's incredibly rich. And I think like almost no other Quiet Please that I have heard, it really demonstrates Cooper's capacity for really innovative, experimental writing. But also, radio as a medium's ability to present that in such a powerful way. And yep. for my money, it is my favorite Ernest Chappell performance. So a fitting a final collaboration between the two.
Yep. Whew. Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you, Amy, for recommending it to me.
Tim, tell them stuff.
Please go visit ghoulishdelights.com, home of this podcast. You'll find episodes that we do there. Of course, you can find them anywhere. But at ghoulishdelights.com, you can leave comments. You can let us know what you thought about these things. You can also find links to like, hey, I want to know what every episode of Suspense you've done. You can just go to our archive page and figure that out. I could tell you now, but you'll figure it out. thank you, Eric. You can also find links to our merchandise store. Get yourself a t-shirt. Get yourself a coffee mug. Get something.
Put on some pants.
Crying out loud. And also find a link to our Patreon page.
Yes, go to patreon.com/themorals and become a member of the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society. If you become a member, you too can recommend an episode to me, which I steal and present as my own recommendation. So again, a thank you to Amy. And there are all sorts of great benefits if you become a member of the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, including, I'm just going to tear off the Band-Aid and say we will give you a little preview of the kind of episodes we do as Patreon-only episodes, and we'll release our Origins of Superstition episode about hat on the bed.
The Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society is also a theater company that performs live on-stage audio drama, doing recreations of classic old-time radio shows and a lot of our own original work, none of which is written this well as Willis Cooper.
Oh. But this is not a script you could do live.
No one would want to see this.
Well, it requires you to go back. They would literally have to stand up and go like Teletubbies, again.
Oh, I'm not doing any more shows for Teletubbies.
We learned our lesson. If you want to see us performing live on stage, please go visit ghoulishdelights.com, where you will see what we're performing, what shows we're performing, where, and how to get tickets. That's ghoulishdelights.com. And if you can't come see us performing audio plays on stage, if you're a Patreon, we record them, and the audio is given, made available.
Can't really lock this
provided
down, can you?
Yeah. This is some audio of those shows, and you get that, too, for being a Patreon. Hey, what's coming up next?
Coming up next, we have a request from one of our Patreon supporters, Cole. Cola suggests we listen to an episode of Suspense entitled Fragile Contents, Death. Until then.
Look out!
Why, Miss Pierce, you left your head inside your hat.